Hi, it's Megan. Before we get to the episode, I want to tell you about the latest development for my project, The Unspeakeasy. It's called the Unspeakeasy School of Thought. As you probably know, The Unspeakeasy's flagship offerings are in-person retreats and an online community for women. Those aren't going anywhere. But beginning in April, we will be offering courses for everyone with an emphasis on intellectual curiosity, artistry over identity, humor, and of course, nuance. We're kicking things off with three writing courses, a fiction workshop taught by novelist Chailey Widger, a screenwriting workshop taught by Hollywood veteran Sam Wolfson, and, are you ready for this? A workshop in something I just declared a new genre, writing your cancellation story. That's right. After having a number of students show up in my own workshops, wrestling with how to tell stories of social or professional exile in the most effective way possible, I thought that there should be a whole class in this subject. And now there is. Best of all, it is being taught by legendary author Sherman Alexie. Sherman's classic novel, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, has sold millions of copies worldwide and is taught in thousands of classrooms every year. He also knows a thing or two about being canceled. This is an incredible opportunity to study with amazing teachers. So if you're interested, go to theunspeakeasy.com, pull down the School of Thought menu, and find out how to apply. Classes begin the week of April 15th. They take place on Zoom, and the application deadline is April 1st. We'd love to hear from you.
She has some very poignant recollections of walking down the street, and if the bus doesn't pull up right in front of you, that means the bus driver is racist. And if you're walking on the sidewalk and there's someone with a dog and the dog barks at you, that could mean that the dog's racist. It could mean that the owner's racist. And even if someone encounters you and smiles, they're probably just faking it because they really hate you because you're a Black woman. And so, of course, they hate you. This is America, after all.
Welcome to the Unspeakable Podcast. I'm your host, Megan Dom. If there were a bingo card for book titles most frequently mentioned on podcasts devoted to free speech and so-called heterodox discourse, the 2018 book, The Coddling of the American Mind, would have to be on multiple squares. At least that's what I think I mean. I haven't played bingo in a while. Written by social psychologist Jonathan Haidt and legal scholar Greg Lukianoff, who now heads FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, it is effectively the Bible of the heterodox crowd. And now it's a movie. My guests are Ted Ballacher, the film's director, and Courtney Moorhead Ballacher, its producer. They're a husband and wife filmmaking team. And in this conversation, we talk about how they took a book about ideas and made an engaging, poignant, and often very funny movie about mental health and the way it's intersecting with higher education and campus life. The movie is also making history in that it's the first film ever to stream on Substack. And so in addition to talking about how they found the students who are the subjects of the film, they talk about what it's like to work with Substack and whether or not Substack is about to be a movie studio. Ted directed the 2015 documentary, Can We Take a Joke?, about the tension between comedy and our increasingly puritanical culture around free speech. Courtney has written and directed several films, including the 2017 biographical drama, Little Pink House, starring Catherine Keener, which you will hear Ted and Courtney refer to here. If you are a paying subscriber to this podcast, you get to hear the whole conversation. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, you will hear the first half. And if you want to hear the whole thing, go to my Substack, megandom.substack.com. You can also just search The Unspeakeable with Megan Dom, and you'll get to it. In the meantime, here's my conversation about the Coddling of the American Mind movie with Ted Ballacher and Courtney Moorhead Ballacher. Ted Ballacher and Courtney Moorhead Ballacher, welcome to The Unspeakeable.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Megan.
For many of the people who listen to this podcast and others like it, the book, The Coddling of the American Mind by Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, which came out in 2018, is a foundational text. I must admit that for all the countless times I've referred to it and talked about it, I never imagined it as a movie. So my first question is, when did you guys discover the book and when did you begin to imagine it as a movie?
Well, let's see. We read the book shortly after it came out, 2018, I guess that was. I think, as I recall, it was late 2018. And we had known Greg Lukianoff for quite a while already. We had worked with Fire for quite a while already. We did, for instance, another feature with Fire in 2016 called Can We Take a Joke? About the clash between stand-up comedy and outrage culture. There was no such thing as cancel culture back then, or at least the phrase wasn't around. So our movie was the first one to touch on cancel culture. So we knew Greg. We had worked together. We didn't know, however, Greg's struggle with depression. And he seems like a guy who has his act together. And I assume that a lot of us have friends and loved ones like that, where you think, wow, this person was that close to doing something that bad. He's got his act together. How could that be? And so that really struck us. And another thing that struck us was that his story, his personal story about his own brush with suicide, was kind of sandwiched in the middle of the book. And we were thinking, hey, this is, you don't sandwich that in the middle of the book. Like you got him. That's part of the story. And what Courtney and I do is, you know, we're filmmakers, but we're kind of very peculiar sorts of filmmakers. We, after making movies for other people and big brands, we started our own production company in 2011 with the motto, making important ideas entertaining. And so we thought, hey, here's this great book, you know, co-authored by a friend of ours, talking about one of the biggest issues in the world. And on top of that, we have a son who is going to be a teenager. He's 9 now. It feels like he's going to be a teenager in about 10 minutes. What if we did a movie about this? And we had the same initial reaction that you had, Megan, which was, there's not a clear path to a movie right here, but we know we can find it. And that's kind of, we like the challenge of finding something that's difficult to adapt. Courtney did it brilliantly, I think, with Little Pink House, a narrative film, which was packed with legal arguments and back and forth and things that could be really, really boring if done the wrong way. And she was the writer or director on that one. And so we liked the challenge, and it definitely fit with our mandate of addressing something that was important. Now we just had to make it entertaining.
Yeah. And we should say that the premise of the discussion around Greg's struggles had to do with, you know, he was dealing with severe depression, and it ended up being cognitive behavioral therapy that helped him the most. And then John and Greg, as they started looking at what was going on with students and at universities, what was being espoused was effectively the opposite of cognitive behavioral therapy, right? Instead of just getting on with your life, trauma was supposed to be just sort of re-enshrined over and over again. So yeah, so in case people sort of aren't familiar with the connection, that is what the connection. Well, so Courtney, did you write a script, or like what, how did you guys kind of just, what was the first step with this?
Yeah. So the way that Ted and I work together under the banner of our own production company, which you just mentioned, we founded in 2011, is whenever we take on a feature documentary project, Ted is the director and I produce. Whenever it's a scripted narrative film, like the Catherine Keener movie, you just mentioned Little Pink House, I write and direct and Ted produces, because my background is more narrative, scripted content, and Ted has a background in journalism. So we have different skill sets. So that said, Ted really was at the helm of this. I was there to help him pull it off and craft it and help the story be as tight as possible. But Ted was the one who found the interview subjects. I mean, he dug around. I mean, he found them. They didn't come to us. Greg and John helped a little bit just because of their relationship, you know, with Heterodox Academy and students on campus who were fans of the book. But Ted did so much digging and so much vetting. So it really was Ted finding our characters, for lack of a better word. And once he identified the students and the people who could tell their story so closely related to the concepts and the importance of the book, that's when we really hit the ground running and doing the sit-down interview. So it was really head. And, you know, anything like this, because we did not have a narrator, so there was no script to it. It's really just taking the best bits from the interviews and cutting them together. And that was a creative decision that we talked about, because with Can We Take a Joke, the documentary about cancel culture and comedy, we did have a narrator, a brilliant comedian named Christina Pashitsky. Her husband is Tom Segura. And that felt like it needed the narration to kind of tie the story between professional comics and what's going on college campuses together. And this one was, I was delightfully surprised to see that the kids, I mean, they're just so good. They're so strong. They're so strong at telling their stories in an interesting and engaging way that it really didn't require a script. The script was really coming from them. And of course, from John and Greg and their magnificent interviews talking about the genesis of the project.
Let's talk about these quote unquote characters. They're real people. They're all incredibly charismatic, incredibly eloquent. Their stories are, you know, different and yet the same. I mean, for a lot of them, what we're seeing are like pretty healthy kids going into college, kind of all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and within not too long of a time, suddenly feeling really mentally unwell. I mean, in one case, the girl had been an inpatient psychiatric treatment before she went to college, but she got better and she went to Stanford. So why don't we go through these kids and tell me who they are and how you found them? You can start with whoever you like.
Sure. Well, you mentioned Lucy. So we can, I guess, start with her. She was maybe the youngest. I want to say she was 19 or 20 when we interviewed her, which is astounding because, you know, Megan, you saw her speak and it's, you just can't believe that such wisdom is coming out of a teenager, or maybe she was 20. So she's finishing up at Stanford in psychology, and she has struggled with autism her whole life. As you mentioned, she had a very tumultuous adolescence. So she was in and out of all kinds of different psychiatric hospitals, sometimes in a, you know, she was literally in a locked psych ward, you know, months before starting at Stanford. And then she makes some very poignant and actually very, I think, funny comments about the difference in expectations between being an undergrad at Stanford and being in a locked psych ward. And that frankly, a lot of the Stanford administrators kind of regarded their undergrads in those kind of fragile terms.
As patients. Exactly. It used to be that they were customers. Remember when we suddenly we were talking about the students as customers, and now they've been upgraded to patients.
Or well, you can charge them even more, I guess, if they're patients.
Yes, maybe insurance will cover.
Right. So yeah. So for Lucy, there was this. You know, she's extremely bright, but she, you know, has had a very difficult time of it, especially during her adolescence. And she says that the doctors told her that there's no way somebody goes from a locked psych ward to Stanford in like whatever it was, 4 months. And that made her want to do it more. She had really turned her life around because she could now function in the world. And this would be a bigger test to see if she could do it. So on the one hand, she did have all these problems before, but she had overcome them, or so she thought. And so she was going into Stanford on the right foot. You know, her life was on the right path. And then, dun da da dun, you know, she encounters the toxic campus environment that is probably familiar to a lot of your listeners now. And then she goes and falls into the rabbit hole of social justice activism through the pathway of disability activism. And she tells the story about how, it's funny, now I still kind of pause when I phrase it, because I'm still worried about phrasing it the wrong way. If you say person with autism, that was, in her view, a very bad thing to say. It literally meant to her ears that you wanted to murder her and murder everybody with autism. And she goes through the mental steps that allowed her to think like that.
Wait, person with autism as opposed to autistic person? Wait, what did she want? Person of autism?
Well, yeah, She said, if you say person with autism, that means you're separating the autism from the person. That means you want to separate the autism from the person. That means you think it's a bad thing. That means you want people with autism not to exist. And that means you support genocide. So she says, in three words, person with autism, I was thinking about genocide. That is not healthy. And it really, you know, Courtney and I were standing back watching what was going on with cancel culture and the campus stuff. And we saw on the one hand, there's one group that kind of makes fun of these students, and then there's another group that enables them. And we didn't want to do either of those two things. We wanted to understand them so we could help them. And in the course of speaking with Lucy and the others, I realized, and Courtney realized, that this is not performative. I don't know, maybe in some cases it is, but for people like Lucy, it is definitely not. And if you go through life, and frankly, she was taught to go through life by various adults in her life, not, you know, of course, she was blessed with wonderful parents. They were part of what helped bring her out of it, but a lot of the other adults in her life taught her to think like this. And it got me to thinking, what would I have been like if I had social media when I was 13 and I was brought up in this idea that people literally wanted to murder me? What a miserable way to go through life. And it just filled me with a lot of compassion for her, because I thought, wow, that could be my son. That could be me. That could have been Courtney. If this worldview, this twisted worldview, can seduce someone like Lucy or someone like Kimmy, who was another one of our characters who also slipped into the social justice activism, again, first-rate person as well. If it can get these people, then it can get any of us.
Yeah, I don't want to ask you your ages, but are you guys like Gen X? Is that how you
identify? I turned 50 this Sunday.
Oh, happy birthday.
I'm okay. Right behind
you. So, yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So this was not really going on when we were kids. We grew up in a different time. Well, that's a question I ask myself all the time, though. Like, what would I have been doing if social media had been around? I was following the herd as much as anyone else a lot of the time. So,
yeah, it terrifies me to think. I mean, look, I hated junior high school. I hated high school. I hated it just because it was, you know, you're sort of like thrown into a pool of the same people year after year. And every awkward thing, every mistake is seen, but it's not recorded. It's not posted. And I just think about these poor kids and just knowing that for all of eternity, something might just be out there about one of the most embarrassing parts of their life, which also is one of the most normal parts of any human being's life. And it was fascinating to me. And just as you said, Megan, like, you know, I followed the herd too, to a certain extent, but it fascinated me just the concept of what that would be like to grow up with social media. And it's not even just them and their friends, their parents are posting stuff. I got their kids and many of my mom friends, they very consciously do not post anything about their kids because, like, I don't want to post something 10, 15 years from now, they see like, Mom, why did you do that? It's fascinating to me. This is not something our parents had to worry or think about. It was really just, how do you get through the day and get to the end of it and then get to the next one? And now it's like, how do I scrub the internet? And we'd love to tell you a little bit about some of the college screenings we did last year before we released the film a couple weeks ago and some of the things that the administrators were telling us who were hosting the screenings. One at Duke in particular said, and this was just back in April, and he said, we have many students who are going back, like before they graduate college, and scrubbing everything because they're about to apply for jobs. And they're freaked out that a joke they made or just an offhanded comment that wasn't even for public consumption will be caught by a future employer. And that just felt really depressing to me, just to self-censor in a way that you're more worried about the future judgment that someone might have of something you did 10, 15 years ago. That was really concerning to us too, going into this story.
Yeah, I definitely want to hear your thoughts about being parents right now and, you know, having, I know you have a young son and thinking about this, you know, in the sense of his own experience, but just back to this cast of characters here. So Kimmy, I think, was the one who stood out in my mind the most. She's an international student from Uganda. She came to study art. She's just absolutely invigorating, vivacious person who also got sucked into this way of thinking. And it's just, you watch her and she's just got so much going for her and so many activities. And she like literally, she touches grass, you know, she's a skateboarder. Like she goes outside and does things and nonetheless got completely in this orbit. So talk about her.
Yeah. Like you said, Kimmy, born and initially raised in Uganda, then moved to Tanzania, and then finally in high school in South Africa. She came to the U.S. for university and she loved it. She says it was the friendliest place I'd ever been to. She talks about how she went to go to the gas station and people would wave to her.
Yes,
and say,
in Los Angeles, no less. She's like, I'm in Los Angeles. This is the friendliest place I've ever been. So that was the shocking moment in the film.
Well, yeah. For Angelinos and former Angelinos like us. Yeah, I guess that would maybe she... Kimmy went to different gas stations than we went to, I guess.
Okay, yeah.
But nevertheless, yeah, she was struck by how friendly everybody was in the United States. But once again, that turned around quickly once she started college. And she was in audio. She wanted to study audio production. She's in music. And that's where she thought her field would be. It is also, she's also an interdisciplinary artist, very talented artist in many ways. So she thought, well, you know, I'm just going to be focusing on audio production. And lo and behold, you think you might be focusing on that, but the university has other plans. And she suddenly learned about terms like microaggressions. And she learned through the process of going to class that she would get better grades if she responded to her professors the way they wanted to be responded to. So eventually, and as she told us on camera, she thought, and she was taught this, that the only thing she had going for her was her sex and her race. So that here was somebody who grew up not thinking about herself in those ways, that she had, like you said, Megan, she's got so much going for her. You don't have to rely on these immutable characteristics to find value and purpose, but that's what she was taught. And so she, like Lucy, descended into this world of social justice activism, becoming suspicious of everyone, trying to cancel people, becoming miserable herself. She tells us that she was borderline homeless at one point because she said, you just can't function. She was taught that, you know, this whole microaggression ideology. She has some very poignant recollections of walking down the street. And if the bus doesn't pull up right in front of you, that means the bus driver is racist. And if you're walking on the sidewalk and there's someone with a dog and the dog barks at you, that could mean that the dog's racist. It could mean that the owner's racist. And even if someone encounters you and smiles, they're probably just faking it because they really hate you because you're a Black woman. And so, of course, they hate you. This is America, after all. And she said that this was something, she's like, it's almost like the KKK created this. This is worse than anything I could imagine, like an avowed racist, you know, teaching to people. And this is coming from our university, supposedly the sources of so much knowledge. And they're, you know, they are at least in name only truth-seeking institutions. Now, they've really dropped the ball on that purpose. A lot of them have. And so she, just like Lucy, descended into misery, making her friends miserable and making herself miserable. She was borderline, you know, drug addicted. When Trump got elected, like a lot of the people that we saw, that just ripped her world apart. She could not handle it. She could not accept that it was happening. And she pulled herself out as well. One of the things I especially like about Kimmy's story is that unlike Lucy and some of the others, she had never even heard of the coddling of the American mind. Yet she did almost all the steps that Greg and John recommend on her own. And it really was through her, she has a Christian upbringing. And so the idea of forgiveness was very present in her mind still, although she had forgotten about it. We see that a trend in these young people that we spoke with is that a lot of times they have a good background. Their family is supportive. They have supportive friends who stick with them. And even though they go into this dark place, when they're at their darkest moment, they were still able to tap into that reservoir of goodwill and family and friends and tradition that they knew. They hadn't completely forgotten about it. It was like, you know, a smoldering ember, and they were able to blow and blow and blow, and then, you know, the fire would return. And it certainly did so for Kimmy.
Wow. Okay. Well, tell us about one more of the subjects, and then I want to ask you how you Sure. found these folks.
Well, Saeed came from the biggest, as he says, the biggest, blackest nation on earth, Nigeria. And he had no idea who Donald Trump was. He had no idea what left or right was. And so you can imagine landing in Lafayette College and being immediately the culture and the students themselves demanding that you adhere to a very stringent slate of ideas or you are out. He was kind of feeling all of this from the other perspective of he didn't himself fall into the same thought patterns as Kimmy and Lucy, but he was still a casualty of this, as was, I've mentioned him briefly, Ariane from India and Anna from New York initially. They all have their stories to tell. They are all affected by this harmful worldview, all in ways that are sort of the same and sort of different.
Okay, so how did you find them?
Well, the easiest was probably Lucy, because she wrote an article for Quillette that talked about her time as a social justice activist. And Greg Lukianoff happened to see it, and he forwarded the article to us. And so we followed up and had some very long conversations with Lucy, and that was that. With Kimmy, it was, frankly, with all of them, it's hard work plus serendipity, I think. I remember finding Kimmy, the first part was her, first time I saw it was her YouTube channel, which was not, I think she just started it or something. And so it didn't have, I don't recall it having many views or anything like that. But she told her story, and it was just one of those YouTube videos, just, you know, a young woman at her kitchen table talking to anybody who would listen. And I was just so struck by it and reached out to her. And then again, you know, had some very long conversations with her, with Saeed and the others. It was usually just a process of talking with a lot of people and talking with more people than they suggest people. It's almost like you have a dartboard and you're not even sure what your target is, but you have some idea and you throw the first dart and you're way off, and you just try to get a little bit closer to the bullseye each time by talking to more and more people. So it definitely was not like, okay, here's just follow this algorithm and then blammo, you're going to find your subjects. It was a very twisty, turny process. But on the other hand, once you encounter people like the young people we did, then you know, you're like, okay, of course we're going to put Lucy on camera, or at least ask her to be on camera, and the same for the others.
Were they reluctant to go public with this? Obviously, Lucy had written about it, so presumably she was more open to that. But did you have to kind of make sure they knew what they were getting into? Was there any kind of trepidation on their part?
Yes. And we agreed to not talk about certain things that, you know, would have made a very emotional story. Although I'm going to say, and it's also a very funny story. People may not think that. Sometimes I'm worried that people are like, oh, great, we're going to go watch this movie about depression and suicide. You know, that's fantastic Friday night. But these subjects are really funny too. And so there's often a lot of humor and tragedy, and they bring that out. But so these very emotional stories would have been, you know, there's even more to them. And Courtney and I agreed to sidestep certain, you know, extremely personal things for the sake of their comfort and their family's comfort and so forth. And it really helped, you know, Courtney, and we had our own, based on a true story, you know, these are actual true stories, but with Suzette Kilo and Little Pink House, Here Was a Very Private Woman. That's the movie that Courtney wrote and directed, starring Catherine Keener. But it was a good learning process for both of us, because here was a person, a very private person, very much like our subjects in The Coddling, didn't want attention, wasn't looking for it. Same with our subjects. They weren't looking for it. And as filmmakers, you just feel that weight of, my goodness, you know, we want to not screw this up. We want to tell their story the right way. And you just really hope that they think that you've done a good job at the end. And so that little pink house experience that preceded The Coddling was very, very important, I think, for me in terms of dealing with some really highly sensitive subject matter here.
Obviously, none of them would have agreed to do it if they had not felt a huge sense of trust with Ted, because Ted was the first interface with them and did the pre-interviews. And the way he handled it to let them feel like they were safe to tell their story was the first, biggest, most important step. Because a lot of it is, how do you come off? Are you being transparent about what you're up to? Because you don't know. And a lot of people are rightly suspicious of filmmakers, especially documentarians that are doing, you know, social justice issue pieces or anything that could be perceived as political. I mean, it's very scary. And I
know, especially now. I feel like documentaries are just so partisan now, especially they're on YouTube. I mean, I don't know.
I agree with you.
The world of documentary has changed
dramatically. It has. It's almost like they've become op-eds as opposed to pieces of journalism where you're really doing a deep dive into all of the different sides and voices. Now, obviously, you know, every documentarian at some point will have some point of view, and that's not a bad thing. But I do agree with you, Megan, that a lot of docs, I feel these days, are just kind of coming in either agenda-driven. Some are even right out propaganda.
Yeah.
And I won't, you know, name titles, but I think that we all kind of know which ones. And look, and some of them are very upfront about that. Like, look, I'm going to make a documentary about someone I hate, and these are all the reasons I hate them, and this is why you should hate them too. That, fine, it's fair game if you're being transparent.
I feel like that shouldn't be called a documentary. Agree. That's my problem with that.
I think it should be called a feature op-ed, whereas Ted and I, and this is largely Ted's skill set, given his impressive background in journalism, he used to produce for ABC News in New York, among many other places. The approach is, this isn't a gotcha piece. We're not trying to exploit you. And that goes back to what Ted was saying. When you're dealing with really sensitive subject matter, the biggest first step you have to take is proving to someone that I'm not here to take your pain or your tragedy and make money off of it. I'm not here to get attention because of trauma that you've experienced. On the opposite end of that, we want to do something totally different. We want to take what you've experienced and help people. We want to take your story and your success story, frankly, and Greg Lukianoff's success story. And that was tough for him to tell, by the way. You know, here's this incredibly successful, highly regarded man, the president of a major organization that is highly regarded. That wasn't easy for him to tell on camera. It's one thing to write it in a book or to say it out loud in an audiobook. That was really brave of Greg, frankly. And I know it wasn't easy for him. And even that, and we've known Greg, as Ted said, we've known him for a really long time, just as friends. We collaborated with him on another film. And he, rightly so, was somewhat nervous about going on camera to tell the story of one of the most dark, intimate parts of a human being's existence. And we had to, just to really wrap, we wanted everyone to feel like this is not exploitative. This is helping. If you tell your story and someone else sees it that's going through the same thing or something similar, you could do a lot of good by being very open and bold.
Yeah, no, I mean, and going back to what you said earlier, the stories are really tragic in moments, but the movie is very funny. I was at the screening, I guess it was the world premiere.
Yes.
Here in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, and people were laughing. I mean, the audience, it was just so, so funny. I mean, the absurdity of some of this logic, if you step back from it at all, it's just like your jaw's on the floor, and it is genuinely funny. And it was really nice to see that the kids were themselves able to see the humor in it.
Absolutely.
They clearly had enough distance.
Absurdities is the perfect word. And that's really where the humor came from, was us all just kind of taking a step back and saying, really? This goes on? You had to do that? You had to say that? You had to behave that way? I mean, it is absurdity. And like you said, I mean, hats off to these students for being able to find that glimmer of light and laughter in this sea of confusion and darkness at times.
One of my biggest questions had to do with the students of color, to use the term of art. Almost, I think all of them were international students. And I wondered why that was.
Yeah, it's a good question. It may very well be.
That was the first half of my conversation with Ted Balaker and Courtney Moorhead Balaker, the filmmaking team behind The Coddling of the American Mind. The movie is streaming on Substack. To see it, go to thecoddlingmovie.com. It's a simple transaction and well worth the very reasonable price. The same is true of the Substack for this podcast, where you can go to hear the rest of this conversation by becoming a paying subscriber. It's megandom.substack.com or The Unspeakable with Megan Dom. It's a great time to join because if you don't, you're only going to hear the first part of the conversation every single week, and you're missing a lot. I'll be back next week with another super nuanced guest. Thanks for listening. See you then.